The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice on hay fever for welcome relief at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Hope all is good with you. It's Catherine sitting in for Ray. We've got a really busy show for you today. Also coming up later will be Coleman Nochter, our resident child psychologist. So if you do have any queries, get them into us and we will definitely pass them on to him. Interesting piece in the paper that caught my eye today, essentially saying, forget about the great outdoors, kids prefer city life. And it's according to a study that's been done by the Journal of Environmental Psychology, where researchers asked 251 children and their parents to rate the attractiveness of a natural or a country environment compared to an urban one. And essentially they found children largely preferred urban places, and it was adults who opted for the countryside, which I found quite surprising, because you always think of that idyllic picture of childhood running around fields and climbing trees and fishing in rivers and the freedom that's associated with that. Like, I grew up in the countryside and that was sort of, that is my picture of it. But I suppose this day and age, when safety concerns are much higher now than they were, it's not quite the same reality anymore. And as a kid, when you think about it, if you can live in an estate surrounded by your mates, I suppose it's easy to see why it's more attractive for kids. So I'd love to know, do you agree? Or do you think generally kids and families are better off having space, nice walks? The only thing is it must be, or it can be quite isolating living if you live in a very rural area. Like, I live in an amazing housing estate in the city. We know neighbours both sides of us. We're always in and out of each other's houses, which I know is not that common in Dublin. It's the first place really in Dublin that I've lived where I have a great relationship with the neighbours, and it does feel very, it almost feels quite countryside, do you know what I mean? We love it. And then when we talk about maybe moving out of the city at a particular time and having a bit more space and all that, I do wonder about the isolation and the social structure for Ellie. She's an only child at the minute. And you really then begin to understand and appreciate living in the city and all the things you have around you. I mean, we can jump on a bus and be in town in 20 minutes. So let me know your thoughts on that. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. I'd love to know also, do you know your neighbours? Because I love hearing other people who live in the city who have great relationships with their neighbours, and I just think it's invaluable. Or maybe why country life is much better for you and your family. I know it's still, I suppose when you grow up in the countryside, you always want to go back there, and that's still how I feel. If you are married and you're a woman, did you take your husband's name or did you choose to keep yours? Colette Sexton on image.ie, she's getting married in a month, and I picked up her article, and she's saying that people are asking her a lot of questions, which, let me tell you, they do in the run-up to a wedding. And one of the big ones is, will you be taking your husband's name? And she writes, no, I'm not changing my name. Why? Because I don't want to. Not because of my job. I never wanted to change my name, regardless of what I do for a living. My future husband is absolutely fine with it. Frankly, if he wasn't, he wouldn't be the kind of person I'd marry anyway. I find myself having to explain this most intimate of things, a name, the way I have identified myself my entire life, to practical strangers who think their opinions should count. It's actually gas, isn't it, when you think about what people say to you and what they think they're entitled to comment on, isn't it? I mean, why would anyone care about such a personal choice? Anyway, she goes on to write, many women feel it's a sign of commitment if they take their husband's name. Good for them. My fiancé and I believe the fact that we're marrying each other, not to mention our 35-year mortgage, already proves that we're pretty committed. So I'd love to hear from you. What did you choose to do? Did you love taking your husband's name? I have loads of friends who loved taking their husband's name, and it showed a real sign of commitment for them. Or if you chose to hang on to your maiden name, why did you choose to keep it? Because it's the question when kids come along, isn't it? Because I know there's people, friends of mine, who went the double barrel option, and they do that in Spain quite a lot. So in Spain, I don't know if it's all over Spain, but certainly in parts of Spain, a child will take the mother's and the father's surname. So say if it's Garcia and, I don't know, Lopez. And then when they get married, they drop the mother's name and they keep the father's name. And that's how it goes there. So they don't end up with six surnames. But let me know your thoughts on that one. ray@rte.ie. Meghan and Harry, they are all over the news today. Why? They're really the couple of the moment, aren't they? They have said they have baby Archie, and they're only going to have one more child if they're lucky enough, and it is to help save the planet. So for environmental reasons, he's done an interview in the September issue of British Vogue, which is getting a lot of press at the moment. Obviously, his Mrs. Meghan is the guest editor, and our very own Sinead Burke features on the cover. So it's the one issue every year that people talk about. Anyway, he did this interview with conservationist Dr. Jane Goodall. She's the amazing chimpanzee lady, and you could tell she was sort of quizzing him on it in the piece, and he has sort of sworn to her that he's only going to have two children because she's warned of the environmental crisis and it won't stop unless we improve access to contraception and all of that. So let me know what you think. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Would you think of the environmental consequences at all if you're planning a family? Look, we're all trying to figure out, I suppose, what the future holds. And on that note, there's a piece in the Mirror today about what our future homes might look like. And there's all sorts of weird and wacky stuff. And then stuff that actually now even makes sense. Apparently, windows changing shade in reaction to external light. So you can control the temperature of your house just through the windows, through the light. Toilets will turn waste into fuel for our homes. Recycling bins are going to be built into appliances like fridges. And there was also then a little separate survey done, and they asked children what they thought houses would look like. This one isn't houses, but the kids thought all cars are going to be battery operated. Every house will have a giant battery to store energy from the sun. There'll be recycling water systems in every house. Again, nothing that's too outlandish, you know. No more light switches in homes. Sensors will control all lights, and people will grow all of their own food inside their houses. So that's children's predictions. Let me know some of yours, ray@rte.ie, or your texts to 51551. All that talk about the future, let's go back in time. This is Anne-Marie 2002. Quirky little song there. That is Anne-Marie. It's kind of summery, isn't it? Catherine, I didn't change my name either. I liked my own, so I suggested to my husband that he would change his. Absolutely no interest, so we just stayed as we were. Do you know, I would actually love to hear from a man who changed his surname to take his wife's name, because you don't hear that very often either. Sure you don't. We were also talking about city versus country living and neighbours, and if you had good neighbours. We're in Dublin in a lovely housing estate. We started an initiative on Wednesdays at 3:30 for parents to bring kids out to play. It's working brilliantly and neighbours are all connecting. It's so important. I also have one child and she's getting to know more people. That is a brilliant idea. Thanks for that, Karen. Catherine, you seriously can't beat Dublin for the great neighbours. I grew up in Donaghmede. I loved the great neighbours and friends are always there for each other. I now live in Leixlip and I'm just as lucky with my neighbours. Also, Leixlip has a great mix of Dubs and Culshies. They're all great neighbours, says Iris. Yeah, and I suppose what I said, I kind of meant me as a Culshie coming and moving to Dublin. I know Dublin had like the Dublin neighbourhoods and there's great sense of community in them. But, you know, if you're apartment living and you move into the city, you don't tend to have a relationship with your neighbours, and it's brilliant when you do. Another one on names, just to clarify for you. Oh, Jesus, did I get this wrong? In Spain, kids get both parents' surname. Usually the order is the father's name, then the mother's name. I have two kids born in Spain and they are Liam Tucky Lafinette and Eilish Tucky Lafinette. If and when either of them marry, their surname will remain the same. Okay, but then do they take their husband or their wife's name after that? That comes in from Owen Tucky. Anyway, thanks for that, Owen. There was a piece over the last couple of days. It was in today's paper. It was in yesterday's paper. Do any of you remember little Hamish, who was the dog that was found on the train station, the Kildare Dublin train, and he ended up on the train and Irish Rail took him in and he was eventually reunited with his owner? Well, there was a little terrier, a little dog, Sarah, who she's been called, and she was found at Newbridge train station a couple of days ago. She didn't board the train. She just was found on the tracks. She's still homeless. She's being looked after by Ted Marr, an Irish Rail engineer and volunteer with the animal charity My Lovely Horse. Ted, good afternoon to you.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm very good. So listen, how did you come to be looking after the little Sarah?
She was put up on the Twitter page. So I saw her on the Twitter page myself. So I just rang the lads in the station. I work in the engineering end there in Inchicore.
Okay.
So I just rang the lads in the station to see how they were getting on. So the two of them had nowhere for her to go, so they were stuck with her in the office. So I said I'd go and pick her up. So,
and come here, they obviously know you're an animal lover because you were the one who looked after Hamish, the dog who made the journey earlier this year.
Yeah, I am.
And
we found his owner.
I know. So this dog isn't chipped or anything, is she not?
No, unfortunately not. I brought her to the vet. That's where she got her name. The vet's name was Sarah, the girl who scanned her in Newbridge Vets.
Okay.
And she scanned her, so there was no chip, unfortunately. There's a collar on her, but there's no ID tags either, so...
Okay, so she has a collar, so she is belonging to somebody. Tell me, what does she look like?
She's a small little terrier with a brown head, basically, a black body brown head. So she's a little tanned head now. So.
Okay, and what sort of like personality is she? Is she frightened or does she seem quite comfortable at the minute?
No, she's like a stray dog. She's looking to go home, if you get me. So she's running around looking for her home. But I have her with my dogs.
Okay.
I have four dogs of my own. And she's just settled in great with them. Like, so she's kind of nearly settling into our house with them more so. But she's a lovely little temperament. She's a really nice little girl.
Okay. And so what happens, Ted, if nobody claims her, which is not going to happen because we're going to make sure she gets reunited with her owner?
No, that's the goal. That's the ultimate goal, is to get her back to her family safely.
Mm.
But we'll hold on to the rescue for 10 days. Now we're going to microchip her today. So when we hand her back, she will be microchipped. But we'll hold on to her for 10 days before we look for a foster home or someone to adopt her.
Okay. So just to say, she's kind of placid little nature. She's a brown head, black body. She was found on the railway tracks just outside Newbridge Station, was it?
No, it was actually in the station itself. It was in the station itself at Newbridge.
Okay. So we'll put up a little photograph of her and people can find her. What's the Twitter page? Is it just My Lovely Horse?
It's My Lovely Horse Rescue. And the same with the Facebook page, My Lovely Horse Rescue.
Okay, and there's a little photograph of her there as well. You do great things in that rescue centre, by the way. So continued success.
Thank you very much.
And hopefully we'll have some good news in by the end of the week.
Yeah, brilliant.
All right, Ted. That's good man. Keep doing what you're doing.
Goal.
Back
All
after
right,
this.
Thanks, Megan.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Keep your texts coming into 51551 and your emails to ray@rte.ie. Mark O'Keefe wrote an open letter to his 5-year-old son, Riley, who is autistic, and it has attracted a huge amount of attention. Riley is non-verbal, and having finished 2 years of preschool, he has been left with no school to go to in September. He needs additional support, and given the lack of available places in ASD units, his parents feel they have no other option than to go public and to try and get him into school this year. And Riley's parents, Mark and Amy, are here to tell us more. Good to see you, lads.
Thanks, Catherine.
And thanks a million for coming in. Mark, I know you from going in and out of Brown Sugar and the salon for years. And there I was at home reading, as I love to do, the papers on the Sunday, open them all up. There's you on the cover of Life magazine. And I said, look, there's Mark. And look, and I thought, this is going to be a great piece on dads and their sons. Riley is sitting up on your shoulders and he's just giving you the best cuddle. And I just thought this was going to be a gorgeous piece on dads and their sons. And then I opened it and I realised it was 3 pages, and it was a letter that you wrote to him out of love, out of desperation. It was a cry for help, and I was it was so emotional and so raw and all you. I was blown away by it, and I'm not surprised the reaction to the piece has been so huge. Tell me about why you decided to write about it and to go public, and was that difficult, and what's the reaction been like? Has it been difficult to try and take it all in?
Yes, I mean, excuse me. The original reason for writing was kind of twofold. First of all, it was motivated because we're sick of no one listening to us. Mm-hmm. We just feel that every time we knock on the door stays closed or falls on deaf ears. And the other side was watching Amy getting very upset by the whole thing. Has been a serious struggle for her over the last 2 years, and the emotion and the negativity around it has just taken its toll on her, and I just felt that I had enough of it all. So I sat down to pen and paper to write a letter, I beg your pardon, which I did do originally to the headmistress of my school that my children's goes to ask her if there's anything she could do to help to try and open an ASD unit in the school that she's in. And I hadn't heard back from her in a 2-week period, so I sat down and wrote this letter to Riley and sent it out to the press hoping it would get traction, and it certainly has.
Mm. And Amy, how has it been for you? We'll talk about Riley, but to go public with something like this when you want to protect your child and you want to protect your family, it's quite overwhelming.
And you're kind of letting everybody into your private circle.
Yeah.
It's the only way we could really raise the topic so well, is that to make sure people were listening was to do this, because every other option we went for, nobody was giving us any feedback. We weren't getting any emails, no phone calls, nothing back. So it was our last option, really. Mm.
Tell me about Riley.
Yeah.
We're going to start choking up again. Right. So he's an incredible child. He's just about to turn six. He'll be six in November. He's very outgoing. He's very adventurous. He's full of love. And life for him is one big playground. Mm-hmm. He couldn't change a hair in his head except for possibly getting talking. But okay. Other than that, in our eyes, he's perfect.
Okay. And when was he diagnosed? Because you, reading the piece, you originally brought him to get his ears tested.
Yes.
He was doing great. He was flying along.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's like when I've got Ellie, who's 16 months,
yeah. Yes.
And you know, you read these things and you start thinking,
all of these
milestones, and then something just happens one day.
Absolutely.
So what happened for you guys?
He just wasn't speaking. There was no little words. Mama and Dada hadn't come, and little things like that hadn't started to come. We were a little bit concerned, not overly concerned, just a little bit concerned. Someone suggested get his ears checked, which is what we did. And they kind of backed up that thought that perhaps there was fluid on his ear. We'd go in and get it drained and grommets, and that would be the end of it. But of course, as I mentioned in the story and in the letter, when they went in and looked, there was literally no fluid on the ear. And at that point, the doctor said to us, you need to go and get early intervention. You need a diagnosis. And we were like, what does this mean? We didn't know what it meant, you know, because we'd never come across it really. I mean, I'd heard of autism, obviously, through Keith Duff, and he made it so much awareness back in the day as well. But I wasn't really aware of what it was.
And I think so many of us are like that. Yeah. You know, we know we hear autism, but we don't actually, until maybe it happens in your family or people close to you, you don't. And it's such a wide spectrum as well, isn't it?
Like,
it's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. So
every child is completely
different. Yeah. And it's so individual. Like, every child is individual for autism.
Absolutely.
The spectrum is so wide. And I was really struck, Mark, by what you wrote that day when you were told in the hospital. You said, I remember this aimless, helpless feeling I had walking out of the hospital, as I was both literally and figuratively confused about where to go from there. I didn't know whether to go left or right or straight ahead.
Yeah.
So you were lost.
Absolutely, 100% lost. And whilst the journey has become a little bit more clear now through all the work that we've had to experience, I'll never forget walking out of the hospital for the first time in my life, really feeling as if we were abandoned, that we were alone in the world. That's exactly how I felt. I felt that we were completely alone in the world.
Okay. You got him into preschool,
an amazing
Amy.
Preschool.
Yeah, tell me about that, and what sort of help he got when he was there.
So he went to an amazing preschool in Donnymead, Early Intervention Support Services School, and the girls obviously took him on. It's a very small knit class. They have obviously different strengths, all the different teachers. He had one-on-one tutor every day, so that was incredible, because generally that wouldn't be a big thing. You wouldn't generally get that everywhere. It's so unheard of because of the lack of resources. So we were very lucky to get him in here. So he had a one-on-one tutor every day, and he did that for 2 years. And he just felt.
Were you, as his mom, seeing every day the little changes?
Oh my God.
The improvements.
In 2 years was incredible.
Like what?
Incredible. Just interaction with other children, how to interact with us, just being around. Like, I can bring Riley everywhere with me. I've never experienced, and they've basically given us that they can, we can bring him out, interact with other children, other adults.
Because how does his autism affect him? Like, we talked about it being really individual.
Yeah.
So he's nonverbal. Yeah.
I suppose before he started in this preschool, he would have gotten frustrated very easily.
Okay.
Because if you brought him anywhere, how you brought straighters or anything like that, he would.
It's all right, love. Take your time. He'd probably get, because I know you've said it, that he'd get frustrated and he could get quite sort of...
He kind of lives in his own little bubble, you know, his own little bubble of happiness, but he kind of expects everything done when he wants it done, how he wants it done.
Sounds like me.
His own agenda.
But you can't negotiate with him, do you know what I mean? And if you try, you kind of usually end up in a bit of a row, one-sided row from him. But what with the preschool that he's been, that's becoming a lot easier. He's starting to understand an awful lot more.
Okay.
And we've seen a huge step forward in that area.
And we know, I mean, even though I know probably not a whole lot about autism, all you hear about is early intervention, early intervention.
Absolutely. And when we found out about early intervention, we assumed that we got a diagnosis and we'd go in and get early intervention the day after. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. we assumed that's just what it was because mm-hmm. everybody was telling us, no, you need to get them on a list and then you get assessment of need. And after that, then you're into the system and everything will be rosy. And that's what we thought was going to happen. And it really didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's when
Even for his preschool, were you funding that? Was that privately done?
Yeah,
privately
that was
done.
Private. And we got a home tuition grant.
Okay.
And that's basically how the home tuition grant covered the school. And we were very lucky again that we could do that. And then the school obviously took him on and they gave him his early intervention like through ABA and other means. But they're so supportive of him. They were amazing.
Okay. So then he's, what age is he now?
He's six in November.
So you started looking like every other parent, trying to get into primary school. And that's when you realised the roadblocks that you were coming up against. So what options were you given?
So basically when Riley started in the early intervention preschool, the girls who work there was basically giving you the heads up to tell you, like, you need to start now looking for primary schools for what they call ASD units. So that's what mothers do when you're in the preschool. We all started ringing around schools. We were given lists from SENO officers of schools and areas as far as Drogheda and Louth. With ASD units in it. So we start ringing these skills.
And with a child with autism, there's a cognitive test or something that before, say the school is that you're enrolling in September, you've got to do that in January?
In January, yes. Basically the application goes in the same as a typical child's application. All the applications go in January as normal.
Yeah.
But we obviously have to give reports and a cognitive assessment.
Okay.
And then obviously they only accept cognitive assessments from the HSE. And that's another battle because of the waiting lists. You have to turn the screw big time to get that on time. Because if you don't get in and it's February and the applications are closed down, the schools won't even answer your emails.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were put on a list.
Yep.
And then you rang around. They gave you, the Department of Education, they gave you a list of suggested schools with ASD units.
Yes.
So you get on the blower and you're on the blower and you're on the blower and you're on the blower.
And they basically tell us, send in your application, send in your reports, everything that we think we need for an application to the school. January comes and then February obviously starts, and that's when all your refusal letters come in.
Okay.
So the refusal.
And the refusal being because there's no space.
No space. Yeah. So basically, I would have had to apply to schools with ASD units.
Yes.
Because mainstream won't accept him because he has a diagnosis. So we obviously apply to ASD units, and then what happens is once you apply, then your refusals come in.
Okay.
So you get your refusal letters.
And just so I'm clear, you know, in terms of the educational options that are available for children with autism, you've got your preschool, obviously, then you've got special schools, primary schools, which are specific for autism-specific classes.
Yeah.
Then you can have an autism unit in a mainstream school. And then you've got a mainstream classes with an SNA.
So we were obviously told when we got our assessments and reports that Riley was mild to moderate on the spectrum. So he doesn't need to be in a special school. A special ASD school would generally be for children that would have extra. So it would be like a learning difficulty, or they might have dyspraxia or something like that. So generally then if they don't have an extra challenge, they get moved on that they're suggested would be a mainstream with an ASD unit. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously what we were suggested to look for.
Okay. So there's no ASD unit locally. How far did you look, Mark? I mean, you're living in...
There are ASD locally. There's one in Portmarnock.
Yeah, so we've got one in Portmarnock.
But none with availability. None with availability. Yeah. Sorry, that's what I meant.
Yeah. None with availability.
And how far were you willing to travel?
Well, I suppose that's a good question. I mean, at one stage there was talk about a school being available or a place being available in Drogheda. Now, I know they provide... transport, if you need transport. For example, Amy doesn't drive. But there's no way we were going to send our non-verbal child on a bus or a taxi for an hour and a half to get to school and an hour and a half back when he can't tell us what was going on in that space. So that wasn't an option. So from our point of view, we would like something local enough to where we are. We're in Portmarnock now, so North County, Dublin.
And you've got three children, Mark, who go to school locally, and the ideal for you and for your family unit would be for Riley to go to
the same school as his siblings. Absolutely. It's a brand new beautiful school. I've been asked not to mention it because they have the right to apply, but it's a fantastic school in the Balmain area and a wonderful team of people working there. I have a great relationship, particularly with the headmistress. She's a fantastic woman, and because it's a brand new building, I believe that there's plenty of room, and as far as I know as well, Amy has an email to say that there's funding been made available for an ASD unit to be open in this school.
Okay, well, when you went public with this and you had a level of support, so tell me about the support that you've received.
It's incredible. It just really blew up for us on Sunday and Monday. We've had so many people obviously Instagramming us and Facebook and loads on social media and contacting us through the salons.
Adam Harris has been very supportive.
Yeah, oh my gosh,
with you as well.
Man. He really is.
So he's the founder and the CEO of As I Am, which is the autism charity, and the brother of Simon Harris.
Yeah.
And they did a survey, which I was reading this morning, called Invisible Children. Yeah. So essentially, Mark, you tell us what that survey is, the Invisible Children survey.
Well, they surveyed 313 families, but and they found that out of obviously 313 these families are all looking for places in school. But he actually believes that there's closer to 1,000 children across the country that are without school places this September.
Okay.
Now, I haven't had a chance to read the report, so I don't claim to be an expert in this field. I'm only an expert in Riley and on our situation.
Mm-hmm.
But he's done some fantastic work, incredible work in for autism.
Okay. And what also struck me when I was reading the piece in the Sunday Indo was your access to various therapies from the HSE can't be accessed unless he is in education.
Yeah. We'll turn down the letter.
So basically, your early intervention is from when they're diagnosed, which is usually between 18 months to 3. And then they're in preschool, hopefully, if you get a preschool place for 2 years up till they're 5. Then it's school age. So once you get moved over to school age, which is your primary school, you're taken off early intervention teams and you're moved over to what they call the school age team. But when you're going onto the school age team, you have to have a school placement. So until you have a school placement, you're not put onto this list. So you're taken off previous lists. And now, right now at the moment, we're not even on the bottom of a list. We're not even applicable for yet until we get a school placed. And then we'll probably put down to the bottom of the list. This list is up to 6 years long.
Oh my God.
Before we get seen by a speech therapist, occupational therapist, some children need physiotherapy. Mm-hmm. So we haven't even started that list yet because we've no school place.
Okay. So what's the plan B?
There's no plan B. Well, you know, if Ronnie doesn't get a school place in September, he's sitting at home for a year. He's going to be just left there to our devices, but he's just left there to waste away. But what's the really worrying thing for us is Riley's not going to press pause. He's going to go backwards. He's going to recess in all the skills that he's already learned in the last 2 years. He's going to forget about those and he's going to end up going backwards. So, you know, we're absolutely up the wall over this because we need to get him a place in the school.
And it's shocking to think that there's 313 children who have not got access to an education, which is a constitutional... it's a constitutional right.
Well, the figures are higher than that.
They're just the registered... We asked for a statement from the Department of Education to before we came on, and we got a very, very lengthy statement, and I just took a summary of it, and I'll give you a read of what they said. While the department does not comment on individual cases, we are aware that some children with special educational difficulties are experiencing difficulty in getting a suitable placement for the new school year. Ensuring that every child has a suitable placement available to them from September is a key priority. Parents who may need advice or are experiencing difficulties in locating a school placement should continue to liaise with their local special education needs officer. Where parents have been refused enrolment in a school, there are established legal procedures in a place to appeal that decision under Section 29 of the Education Act 1998. The government is spending nearly €1 in every 5 of the education budget on special education, about €1.9 billion in 2019. We have significantly increased the availability of special placements for children with special education needs, which without doubt they have.
Mm. Yeah.
But that's no good for you if you can't get your child in locally.
You're trying to contact one of these special needs officers extremely hard as well.
Okay.
Like, we've been working with them, and when I say working with, you try and contact them, it's near impossible. You send an email, you might get a reply for up to 2-3 weeks. Your phone calls, most of them, they leave their voicemails full, so you can't leave a message. So it's near to impossible to get a contact these officers. Mm. So you have to do it yourself. So you might get a contact off one of them, or they might send you an email of something just bare, an option. And that would be it. That would all you'd be hearing from them. And that's they think that they're helping. Mm. They're supposed to do a job of giving you places. They don't tell you where this place is available or how we can contact or anything like that. They're the ones that give us this list of up to 20 skills and tell us to contact them ourselves.
And the Minister has done some great work. I mean, I believe from speaking to Adam yesterday that they're currently making 80 places available in the Dublin 15
area. Yeah.
Children who need ASD units. So that's incredible for people in the Dublin 15 area. But there's a lot more places in Dublin that need this support. Mm-hmm. And the Minister has the power to make schools open ASD units, and he can make funding available.
Mm. Hi, Catherine. I'm a dad of a 12-year-old child with ASD. I'm listening to Riley, Amy and Mark's story. They are one of very many children in the same position. Year on year, this is a worsening problem. It's scandalous on so many levels. I'm crying my eyes out here. There is a huge another text message here. There's a huge shortage of properly trained teachers, even in an ASD unit. That's if you can get a place. That comes in from Philo. It's like my story. My son is autistic and struggles with verbal skills. He is never accepted by the other kids due to this, and it breaks my heart. Services are not good in this country. And that comes in from Stephen. I'd imagine, Amy, just on a day-to-day and a week-to-week basis, the frustration and the growing concern must never be out of your... And you've also... You're the mom of an 11-week-old baby.
Yeah.
Frank.
Congratulations, by the way. It's great
he's
news.
He's coming everywhere with us.
Yeah.
So he obviously... Yeah, so obviously while I was pregnant, and then obviously I got very sick towards the end of my pregnancy, out doing marches and the whole lot, so you can imagine.
You were protesting when you were 7 and 8 months pregnant.
Well, my anemia, but I actually had the mumps, and I was out protesting in the Latin the Rain and the Enough Was Enough protest outside the door that day, and I had to leave. I had to actually ring Mark and ask him to come and collect me, that I wasn't feeling great, and I ended up in hospital that evening with the mumps. Mm. So it's been very, very stressful. And then obviously as June was approaching, any mum that I would be friends with, I've got an amazing group of friends we work with from the school that we've been working with an amazing TD called Aidan O'Riordan. He's amazing and he's been really helping us. And as June was kind of coming quicker, we were all getting very worried.
Panicked,
because we all know school's closed and there's nobody there. So for the whole month of the summer, nobody's going to contact us. And when the school's reopen in August, they're hardly going to put us on the top of their list. Mm. Get contact then, to make sure or see how we are. Nobody's going to ring us to see how we are or how we're getting on, because I won't say, they're already busy, they don't care. Do you know that way?
Have you had support, Mark, from other parents and other families in the same boat as you guys?
That's the one thing I didn't really expect. I hadn't thought about that, the amount of people that has contacted us over the last few days through Instagram, Facebook, etc., and telling us their story. And of course we've read every single message, we've replied to every single message, and they're all so similar but yet so different for reasons that we've already touched on. And my God, it's been heart-wrenching. Like, you know, you read that story and you felt that way. Well, I felt that way by probably by 300-400, because every single story is everybody's touching. And we're very happy that we've been given this opportunity by wonderful people like yourself in the media to be able to be their voice and get this out there.
Mm. What would you like to happen now? I mean, I know what you'd like to happen. I know you'd like Riley to be going to school in September with his brothers and sisters.
I'd like people who are in jobs of importance, who have these roles, to step up and do their job properly. I'm asking just to do one thing. They put themselves forward. They put themselves in these roles, and they're going to be remembered for what they do here. And I'm asking them to get involved and make ASD units and make places available for children who need the help. Mm. These are those vulnerable people in our society. We've done great things in this country for LGBTQ. We've done great things for women's rights and all these kind of things. And we've got to look after children. Mm. And these children need the most help of all. Mm. And that's what I'm asking them to do, is just step up and do their job.
Mm-hmm. I've been working closely with Amy and others for the last number of months on this issue. Amy has been treated disgracefully by the system, but has been a fantastic campaigner. A family with an autism diagnosis should be surrounded by care, not have to go to war for a school place. And that comes in from Senator Aidan O'Riordan. So he's been on your side by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Listen, all I can do is wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so
you
much.
And the other 313 children, and as you say, Mark,
it's
I don't know,
more.
Possibly
yeah.
or
more,
highly likely more. You don't think about a child not having an education, and that's what they have a right to. So,
yeah.
Listen, to Riley and to all of you, thanks a million for speaking out. Thank you for writing such a personal and heartfelt letter as well, Mark. And I know it wasn't easy for the two of you coming in today. So, thanks a million. Back after this.
Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Keep your texts coming in to 51551 and your emails to ray@rte.ie. Our child psychologist Colman Nochter is going to be in very soon. So if you do have any problems or any queries for him, get them into us and we will get them over to him. Now, Clelia Murphy is in studio with me.
What an incredible couple.
Listen, aren't they amazing?
Yeah.
Aren't they amazing? And it's when you have to fight the fight for your child like that publicly. And you could tell that Amy was still, she's still kind of coming to terms with getting out there and making it as public.
But you have to kind of fight your own corner. That's the thing that you'll learn, especially as a parent. You have to kind of, doing the right thing for your child and trying to figure out what that is. Because nobody teaches you that. I'm sure you find that now as well.
Already. And she's only...
Like, Clarabelle's 21 now. And I'm parenting an adult. Nobody prepares you for that.
Yeah,
so when I see somebody who has got a... You know, parenting is hard.
Mm.
That kind of parenting is even harder for them because they have to fight.
Absolutely.
So people need to start listening.
What is the best thing about being the parent of a 21-year-old?
Well, I'm wearing her dress now. I mean, that's a good one.
Mighty fine in it too, I have to say.
Clelia Murphy has better taste than I have. There's one.
You're just after coming from the gym as well,
yes.
Right?
Well, I'm doing a show called Gym Swim Party for The Fringe. So if I don't get myself... And I'm playing the goddess Aphrodite in it, right? So if I don't ask, I'm totally not qualified to do this.
You absolutely are.
I'm playing the goddess Aphrodite. It's set in two warring gyms.
Brilliant.
It's a modern take on the Trojan War, and I'm playing the goddess of war, the goddess of love, and I'm there kind of sprinkling my kind of magic about it, and it's really exciting, and it's a dance show.
So is it kind of a piss take of the way the gym culture now, and that we all it's a power struggle.
There, you've nailed it in one.
Okay.
Actually, we're going to have you for PR now. But the thing is, it's actually a real kind of discussion about that, and you know, the notion of the body beautiful and what we're kind of doing and why are we doing it? And are we fit for now? Are we fashionably fit? Or are we going to be fit for when we're 90? Like, are we killing ourselves in the gym now and are we genuinely fit?
That's the way I have changed my mindset in the last, I would say, 6-7 years.
Yeah.
Like, I always liked being fit because I liked the feeling that it gave me.
Yeah.
But I liked getting into the skinny jeans as well.
I've never gotten into a pair of skinny jeans. if before I die, I hope to get into a pair of skinny jeans.
And
I'm not that shapey.
We are going to talk about something that is very exciting.
You're getting a bit of
an exclusive.
An exclusive, yeah.
But going back to what you were saying, when you talk about being fit until you're 90, that for me is what it's about now. And
100%.
I think when you get into your 30s, or you, for the first time, you lose somebody close to you, or you get a friend with a diagnosis, Porrick lost both his parents in the last couple of years. When that starts happening, and I think the older you get, the more you go, this is not about the skinny jeans.
Nope.
This is actually, will I get to 70, 80, or 90?
And then you listen to... has to start.
Yeah, and you listen to the likes of Professor Niall Moyna in DCU, and he was like, you could get to 70 or 80, but how mobile are you going to be when you're there? So it is about looking after your health.
But it's also bringing it back. So, okay, I'm 43 now.
Right.
And I still don't have a healthy attitude to food. I still don't have a healthy attitude to working out. And it's at this point in time now that I have to approach that and say, okay, you're doing another job. So on the back of this really fantastic piece of theatre, right, because I'm so excited to do this. This is the kind of reason I left Fair City for the first instance, because I'm working with the likes of Louise Lowe. I'm working with all these young actors and actresses that are making their way. And the excitement is all in the Fringe. It's in the O'Reilly Theatre. It's with Laura McNaughton, who's the producer. These are all people that I've dying to work with for years.
Mm.
Gavin Costick. I've been writing to Gavin Costick for 22 years saying, hi, Gavin, give me a job. And it's finally happened, right? So this is for a personal thing. This is kind of really excitement.
And are you enjoying this new life?
Yeah,
you kind of feel like I get this energy from you that like, you know, it's different gigs, it's getting out there. When you were on Fair City for so long.
Yeah, but you're getting out of your own way. Like, Fair City was great and I'll never run it down because it allowed me be not a stay-at-home mum, but it allowed me put that roof over our heads, that being an actor sometimes it's very difficult to do that as an actor.
Mm.
We're we're very much going from gig to gig.
Mm.
And I don't know when the next gig will come in. So I, whatever I get paid this month has to do me for the next couple of months.
Sure.
And I have to be mindful of that.
Sure.
Whereas Fair City kind of allowed me to be a little bit more structured. So taking the bullet and kind of seeing myself, if, like, if you want to be seen differently, Catherine, you have to see yourself differently. Or people won't see you differently.
And so, we saw you differently on Dancing with the Stars. You were just magic. Was it absolutely terrifying?
It was genuinely the most terrifying
job. You were
like
brilliant on it, so you were.
I have to look back at it. I didn't feel brilliant on it at the time.
Why?
Because you're kind of going, geez, this is so completely foreign to me. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm doing it because I'm terrified. I'm doing it because I didn't think that I could do this. And that's to turn down a job like that because you think you can't. Try it out first, then turn it down.
Mm.
So
But with a show like that, you literally are catapulted into
Catherine. People have to do it. Do it.
Oh, but you see, I think I am Jennifer Lopez on the dance floor. And that's after I've had one or two drinks. And then I watch myself back on somebody's phone and I go, oh,
no, you're not Jennifer Lopez. You're Kelly Murphy, go home. I thought that as well.
Totally.
I genuinely thought, I have a few moves. I can do this. But doing your moves,
guided by somebody else.
Try to coordinate yourself with somebody else. It's not like being on the wedding dance floor. It's not like being with the hairbrush in your bedroom. It's counting. It's mathematics. Like I had, the stars of that show are the dancers.
But you have amazing natural rhythm, without a shadow of a doubt.
That's what I thought.
Ah, and then
I
was trying
to, then you, but that's what I'm saying. Then you're matching rhythm to the beat of the music, and then the other human being that you have to dance in coordination with.
And then I know you've talked about the younger, like fitter dancers, whether they're the professional dancers or the other contestants.
Well, I was the oldest in the competition. Once Eyelash left, I was the oldest.
Eyelash,
who I was great pals with beforehand. So, like, I went in and I made all had her, and then I made all these other fantastic pals: Mairead Ronan, Peter Stringer.
Yes,
right. So this is where I have to talk about myself and Peter Stringer. So Peter Stringer is turned into a great pal.
Did you ever think you'd be mates with like rugby star Peter Stringer?
Never would have considered it. There's not many.
Do you know anything about rugby?
Well, I know that the ball is a weird shape.
Yes,
and that's about it.
Okay,
right. And I'd follow it, like, you know, I'm a laissez-faire kind of rugby fan. Like, once they get to the final, oh, I'm all over it. Do you know what I mean? Kind of an a la carte fan.
Yeah.
We're a bit a la carte. So I did my usual. I rang up Peter Stringer there a couple of weeks ago. I said, hiya. I said, I'm doing another play and it's called Gym Swim Party and I'm supposed to be the goddess of the gym. I said, will you do me a few sessions? Will you get me back into shape? And he went, no. Absolutely not. I am not going to encourage you to yo-yo diet. I'm not going to encourage you to yo-yo train in the gym. If you're serious about it and you want to do this, I will train you, but we're going to have a goal in end and a goal in sight. And it's not about changing or training for that one gig. It's, are you prepared to change your lifestyle? Are you prepared to really do it? And I went, oh, yeah. And in the back of my head, I'm going, oh, yeah, just say whatever he needs to hear
just
now,
Kelly,
and just get him on, get him out, and get into, get ready for it, right? But that's been the mistake that I've made all the way through, right? I'll get to a certain level of fitness, and then I'll reward myself with a bottle of Pinot Grigio and a hamburger, right? That's not going to work, right? That's a life out of balance.
Yes.
And that's what I think is going on with a lot of us right now.
Absolutely.
And if... So anyway, Stringer says to me, look, if we're going to do this, what is in the back of you? Like, where do you, what do you want to look like? What kind of, you know, things do you see in the gym that you want to achieve? What kind of a look?
Mm.
And I said, well, genuinely, to be honest with you, the women that I'm kind of really impressed by are, you know, those bikini models?
The fitness. Stop it now. Which sort of bikini? There's all sorts of bikini models out there at the minute.
So we're not talking bodybuilding.
We're not talking Love Island.
We're not talking Love Island.
Okay.
Right? We're talking the fitness bikini model that is shaping herself via her mind and getting that kind of... I said, I want to be ripped. He said, if you want to be ripped, grand. We're going to do a ripped.
So you want shoulders, like, you want abs, you want thighs. Do you want to like have that spray tan and stand in high heels and flex your biceps?
I didn't until Peter Stringer said to me, right, well, if that's what you want to look like... I challenge you to enter the competition.
Did you accept that challenge?
Well, what happened was, I kind of went, well, just give me a second to think about that for a sec. And I went into a health food store, right? This is a true story. Went into a health food store and I was talking to the lad behind the thing as I was buying protein because I'm a bitch for skipping meals.
Right.
At least if I have a protein shake, that's a meal, right? And I said to the lad behind
I would tend to disagree, but continue.
Would you?
Yeah.
But this is where it's fascinating. This is why I want to talk to you more about this.
Okay.
So, because I skip meals.
Yes.
Not intentionally, that's just bad habit. And that's when I get unfit and that's when I lose motivation. And that's when I get out of balance.
Yes.
Right, so I said to the lad behind the counter, I said, you see the girl on the poster there? The fitness bikini model. How long will it take me to get to that? And it took him 10 minutes to stop laughing.
Stop.
So I rang
Clelia.
It's true. I said to him, I said, okay, thanks very much. So I rang Peter Stringer. I said, right, you're on. So what we're going to do is we're going to...
I love this.
Right? Like, our core question is this. We bonded over a couple of things. We bonded over the fact that we've both left careers after 22 years. We bonded over the fact that he naturally thinks like this. So he is an athlete. So my question is, can he teach me? And if he can teach me, then anybody can learn.
Mm.
So he's going to teach me. We're going to put it on videos on Instagram. He's Stringer 9. I'm Clelia Murphy. And we're going to put them out every week. And if people want to do it with us or add to the comment or come along with us for the drive till I get ready for this show.
So have you given yourself a timeline? Is there a date for a show? Or
there's a show in April, and that's what we're going to aim towards.
So Clelia Murphy,
yeah,
is going to be a fitness bikini model
in April.
In April, under the guidance of Peter Stringer.
Yeah,
this is possibly
the
best news that I've heard all week.
Well, thank you for that, Captain Thomas. I'm going to be drilling you for loads of information as well. I'm becoming a bit, because it's about learning. It's about,
but this is it.
Balance. So I'm going to go to extremes in order to discuss balance. This is all about knowing your good fats from your bad fats. This is all about knowing your good fats from your bad fats. This is about knowing your McDonald's from your macros.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I want to explore. This is
and
what
I think
want
you
to
hit,
learn.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, because some people could say that is too extreme and, you know, if you want to get in shape, you don't need to go that far.
No, you
but
don't.
But actually...
But I need a goal. I know myself well.
You need a goal, and I think you need to do it under the guidance of somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Well, it's
and
funny.
That is,
your man in the shop said to me, you need a trainer. You need a really good trainer. And in my head, I'm going, do I now? Right, well, I have a really good trainer. So I'm going to ring up Peter Stringer and say, I accept your challenge. But it's not about... This is not about... The body beautiful. This is about training your mind, because it doesn't start. I listen, if it, this helps one young fella or one young girl out there in their room, in their house, thinking they're trapped by their own bad habits.
Mm.
This is to say, look, we're all trapped by these bad habits, and it's, you start small. It's one good habit every day will make huge change. So if they want it, now I could fail. I don't know if this is going to work, like... I'm going to take on the challenge.
And take it head on with positivity as well. You've got to believe in yourself that you can
100%.
Do it.
100%. Well, no, it's good to have one person outside you saying, because I said it to him, I said, do you think I, because this fella's after laughing me out of the shop. And he said, do you think you can do it? And I said, yeah, I think I can do it. I said, well, then if you think you can do it, Clelia Murphy, then I think you can do it.
Yeah, you're 90% there.
And if I can do it, my question is, can I have my glass of Pinot Grigio and drink it? Can I have my cake and eat it? And Peter Stringer tells me I can.
Mm.
So if anybody else out there is interested in coming along this journey, it's starting on Sunday. And this play starts on the 12th of August. Right? So, so please buy the tickets for the play. And if we're looking to talk about balance. We want to get balance back into people's lives.
Brilliant. Listen, the play again is called Gym Swim Party. It's part of the Dublin Fringe, September 11th to 15th in the O'Reilly Theatre.
Don't miss it.
We better get that in.
This is the stars of the future.
But.
Yes.
The Gym Swim Party is starting with you in your bikini.
Yeah. And not just a bikini. The high heels, Captain.
The high heels.
Now, Captain
and the
Thomas
fake tan.
Knows me a long time. She knows that I'm neither high heels or fake tan.
Always a pleasure. I think you're fabulous.
Well, we'll be
and best
you
of luck with
way.
Both the play and the challenge. And good luck to Peter Stringer as well. Stringer.
Actually, he needs prayers.
You thought playing for Ireland was difficult.
Oh, no. Yeah. He's after taking on the challenge of his life.
Back after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Thanks a million, John. We were talking about names and women taking their husband's names if they're getting married. Hi, Catherine. I kept my own name after I got married. Like that journalist, I thought that getting married in itself was commitment enough. We double-barreled our children's names. Even as a child, I couldn't understand the concept of changing my name. Also, it took me about 4 years after being married before people stopped referring to me using my husband's name because I refused to answer to it. Somebody else texted in, Hilda texted in, I married 38 years ago today. If I was as wise then as I am now. I would not have changed my name and would have used my surname as the family name. My husband's surname is very common in the area, and we'd used my name, life would have been much easier in relation to postal deliveries and the like. And then we were also talking about city living versus country living. And Tom says, Catherine, I'm Dublin born, but I love both the city and the countryside, as both my parents were from the countryside. That said, I could never see myself living anywhere else but Dublin due to the convenience of everything and because I just love city life. Also, I had a terrific childhood as I was lucky to grow up in an area south of Dublin with lots of friends and two fabulous parks where I spent all my summers. See, that's it. I think if you have the convenience of everything that comes with an urban space, but you have big open spaces as well, parks and the like, then you sort of get the best of both worlds. Anyway, keep the text coming in, 51551 or ray@rte.ie. Now, Italy's Supreme Court has banned homemade school lunches, saying that it ruined the sense of equality generated by students when they sit down together and eat and they're eating the same thing. The parental struggle to prepare healthy school lunches for children is on our agenda today too. So to talk more about this, I'm joined by Mummy Cook's founder, Siobhan Berry. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
So listen, thanks for coming in. Now, you carried out research with, was it 500 parents?
Yes, so we asked our Mummy Cook's mums how did they get on with packing their lunch.
Okay, and 80% of them, which I found staggering, said they're struggling to make a healthy lunchbox that their child would actually eat.
Yeah.
So what's going on? Like, what sort of reaction and what sort of feedback were you getting?
So I guess because I have school going children, like, I'm quite well aware of it. I think what's happening is that children tend to be a little fussy. So what the parent does is they pack the lunchbox with so much food in the hope that they'll eat something.
Okay.
And then the lunchbox comes back uneaten and there's no consequence. And this happens day after day. And then they end up kind of packing it with maybe less healthy stuff so that they will eat it. So you end up, and if you keep offering kind of cheese sandwich day after day, the child will get sick of the cheese sandwich. And also, like, if you look back at where's the vegetable in that, it's not getting in there.
Okay.
So parents need to do is they need to go back to maybe like what we talked about with the weaning stages, where it was like always batch cooking for the family. You need to get back into the kitchen and you need to prepare and plan ahead. So for me, I would have, out of the 5 days, I would have three of the meals would be in a food flask. So they would be like, I would prepare like a marinara sauce at the weekend or bolognese, freeze it off, cook the pasta in the morning, just takes 10 minutes, heat the flask, put the sauce on. And that's a really healthy meal with vegetables in it.
Mm-hmm.
I also think where they're going wrong is they're not allowing the child to maybe pack the lunch. So when you empower the child or you give them some control, they're more likely to eat it. Now, within the confines of maybe making sure that they understand what a protein, a carbohydrate and a fruit and veg is, and that there's one of each in there. So for my own kids, they don't like tomato or lettuce in a sandwich, which is, you know, where the vegetables come in.
Yeah.
But I make a courgette pesto. And that is, it's delicious. They love pesto. It's nut-free. And they just spread it on the sandwich and they have their meat and their cheese on it. And that's a very nutritious sandwich.
Okay. So it is about taking the time,
yes,
and going the extra mile,
yes,
in order to ensure they get the right amount of nutrients and the right amount of food in their lunchboxes specifically.
Yeah, I think, like, if you're already doing it with the dinner, you just,
yeah,
make an extra bit of dinner and you have leftovers in the flask the next day. Making pesto actually takes about 5 minutes. Making hummus does as well. So it's really just kind of allowing the time to
And what do you
it.
Think with what Italy have done? They've,
yeah,
said, like, just to get a sense of equality, everyone sits down together, they're not eating the same thing. I remember being in primary school and longingly looking into everybody,
yeah,
else's lunchbox because, you know, I was doing the sneaky swaps. If somebody had a Nutella,
yeah,
sandwich and,
yeah,
you had, you know, a ham salad sandwich, and,
yeah,
you'd be like, you'd be killed doing trade-offs. So you'd get the Nutella sandwich or the penguin bar,
yeah,
or
and
whatever.
And it's not allowed, actually. It's because of the whole allergens in schools, but it does happen. When we surveyed the Mummy Cook's mums, they said that actually the biggest struggle they had was that the child only had 10 minutes to eat the food. And I asked, and I, you know, we asked our mums that were primary school teachers, and you know, unfortunately, there's a very little time there. So they do only have 10 minutes and the rest is out on the yard. So you're kind of, it's a catch-22. Do you take away the time from the yard to give to the food? But I don't think 10 minutes is enough for anyone,
especially
a four-year-old, to open a flask, to eat it, to listen to the all this, you know, the chatter around them. The teacher's not present either because she's having her lunch or he's having her lunch and there's a sixth class there. So there's nobody to help them. So I would say, I think that, you know, the idea of a canteen is a really amazing idea because everybody's eating the same food, yes. Mm-hmm. And then everybody's, you know, you probably have more time as well.
And in an ideal world, every primary school would be like that. We know that's not the case.
No.
There are primary schools who have rules and regulations. What do you think of that in terms of this is not allowed, no crisps allowed?
Yeah.
How is that?
I think that's really important.
It's not too nanny state.
No, I think it's really important because, like, my kids went off to camp as soon as school ended and they were coming back crying to me saying, you're the meanest mom in the world. People are having wagon wheels and tater crisps. And I just wouldn't give in to them. I was absolutely, I'm not packing that in the lunch, but it's almost like in the camps, it's a bit different. But I really like that the schools are very strict about it. And okay. I think they have to be, and especially with nuts as well. So our school will be a nut-free.
The nut allergy thing. There's so many children
it's
now.
One in every class now.
Why is that, do you think, that we're seeing more and more of it?
Well, I don't know. They're saying like it's just that we're too clean and also that we weren't introducing nuts early enough. Mm. So when I teach mums about weaning, I always like introduce it, unless you or your partner has a nut allergy, you introduce it very early, or that when you're pregnant you eat the nuts as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something to do with that, but no, definitely it's kind of scary how many children do have nut allergies.
Mm. Okay, so your top tips are batch cooking, homemade pestos,
empowering the child,
food in a
control.
flask, because I think that's the one thing we all, it's like you, as soon as you say school lunch you think sandwich.
Yeah, and that, like, I wouldn't like 5 days of sandwiches. I, as I said, like, the girls have noodles one day, they have an omelette with vegetables in another day, they have pasta with a sauce on it, they may have leftovers. So I might only have one sandwich during the week, which is great because it's a lot easier. Another really big top tip is when they come home, they get a second chance. And this is where I'm very strict. So I wouldn't allow them, like if I open the lunchbox and there's something not eaten, they have a second chance to eat it before they get their snack. And if you don't have that consequence, they're not going to eat their lunch. And this is where parents are going wrong, where they're overfilling the lunchbox. And sure, the child could never eat all that. So you can't really do that with
So
that.
Lessen the load in order for them to meet.
It's portions.
Yeah.
Back to portions. Back to, obviously you're not going to put all things that they don't like in there. So you put like comfortable foods with uncomfortable foods. In our house, we do a thing called Try It Tuesday. So every Tuesday, we all think up of something that's new that we might try. And we try it. And if they don't like it, they don't like it. That's fine. It's just about,
that.
Yeah. It's like it either comes into the lunchbox or it comes into the dinner. But it means that I'm not cooking the same dinner week after week.
Yes.
And they have something, you know, they've
evolved. They're expanding their taste buds and everything else.
Yeah.
When do you do treats?
So we do treats at weekends.
Okay.
And I always say to them, she can go mad at the weekend.
Yeah.
And then they forget.
Because they don't know it's Saturday.
They forget. Well, obviously, if they see
in the summer, you don't know what day it is.
Oh, no, yeah, that's different in the summer. I always think that, you know, if you've sugar, if you're eating sugar, you crave sugar. By the end of the week, they forget that they haven't had it and they're like, oh, God, it's Sunday.
Listen, lots of good tips and advice coming in there. That's Siobhan Berry from Mummy Cooks.
Cooks.
So thanks, Emil.
Thank you so much.
Let's take a quick break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We were talking to Mark O'Keefe and Amy, mom and dad of Riley there, who has autism and has not been offered a place in primary school in September. Lots of messages coming in. Catherine, very well done to Riley's mom and dad, Amy and Mark, for flying the flag on this issue. I too was in their shoes 3 years ago when I was sent 8 rejection letters for my son, who was 8 at the time and struggling desperately in the mainstream setting from schools with ASD units within the South County Dublin area. My calls of help fell on deaf ears. I literally had nowhere else to turn when a call came through at the start of June by sheer luck. There is no support network within the educational system for children with autism. There is a giant hole in the system. It needs to be radically overhauled. The onus is completely on parents of autistic children to fight and desperately try everything they can to get their children the education they deserve. And that comes in from Melissa. As I said, huge reaction to Mark and Amy's interview earlier. Colman Nochter, good to see you.
And Tired, good to see you.
How are you keeping?
I'm good, thanks, yeah.
Good. You are in studio this afternoon, as always, to help deal with our parenting issues. And as I said, if you have any queries for Colman, email ray@rte.ie. So will we jump straight in? Because I always feel that I run out of time and can never get through as many as I'd like to. So let me just jump straight in here. This email came in from a listener. Hi, Catherine. My 10-year-old son suffers with anxiety and it's all around health. She's convinced herself she has cancer and is afraid to die. She's been to doctors. There is nothing physically wrong with her. Doctors say it's physical signs of anxiety. Can you help advise what road to go down? Many thanks. And I know this person is not looking for my help. They're looking for your help.
Yeah,
this
is a common one and it's common at this age. These are what we call somatic concerns. So children consumed with pains in tummies or death or dying. Sometimes children feel terrified about falling asleep, that they won't wake up. And it's a manifestation of anxiety. I wouldn't get at all engrossed in the somatism, as in this girl's been brought to GPs and things to see if she's physically okay. I'm guessing to reassure her that she's not, but it's actually nothing got to do with the somatism. This is about permanency. So This is the age of typically around 8, 9, 10, where the child begins to have an age of reason. They start to realise the world is a little more complex than it was before. They're starting to get independence. People are starting to expect more of them to be able to be independent, responsible, and they just get overwhelmed by that anxiety and they feel it in their bodies. So these children don't have articulation to say, I'm really worried about the future, or I'm worried about I'm getting overwhelmed at school or whatever.
Yes, yeah.
So when we don't have words, when language fails, behaviour takes over. So if we can't have words to express it, we'll feel it. We feel it in our bodies. And this kind of somatic feeling of worrying about pains in tummies or dying or headaches or sometimes cancerous tumours, these sorts of things, it's this manifestation of anxiety. So deal with the origin of the anxiety, not the symptom. So It's trying to reassure her about permanency, that nothing's going to change, that she's safe, that anything that happens to her, that as parents, you'll get it, you'll manage it and help her to get through it, and just reassuring her by keeping things as steady and contained as possible, and this should pass. This is generally something akin to a phase that a child will tend to settle out of. If it doesn't and extends past a kind of a 6-month period, then you'd kind of look to maybe she needs some help to manage her anxiety. But generally, this is things that they will grow out of and manage quite easily.
Okay, so it's starting small and sitting down with her and talking through what, you know, where and how and how she's feeling.
The use of stories is wonderful with this. Read stories with them and teach about what it is to feel anxious, what it is to feel worried, what it is to feel scared. Not overly hamming the issue, because if you are talking about worry all the time, we make it an issue.
Sure, in some respects.
But just it's about teaching her to not sweat the small stuff. So, you know, in terms of you've got your family, you've got support, and reminding her of all the scaffolding that's around her, as opposed to it being very threat-focused, which is, I guess, the lens that she's seeing the world is very threat-focused. So I play it down, but manage to bolster her up. It's building her up, as opposed to necessarily managing her environment for her.
Okay. My daughter is 12 and is heading to secondary school this September. She was caught kissing a boy online, surrounded by her friends who were cheering. Generally, she seems to be very interested in boys and overtly sexual or overly sexual for her age. Is there anything I did wrong as a parent to lead to this behaviour, or is there anything I can do to change it? Wow.
That's a good question. I mean, this comes up all the time, Catherine, and it rather than getting into, because how much is too much in terms of sexual intimacy for teenagers? It's a topic that we say in teenage years, it's all about the hormones, but we never talk about the hormones because
yes,
it's uncomfortable. So
yes,
the issue is parking the morality of whether this is too young or whatever, because how much is too much depends on your individual. It's a very subjective
totally
view. So from the point of view, if we park that, the issue here, and this is again something that I think is normative but not normal. So this is the issue of, so the issues of teenage sexuality in terms of performative. So this is like children who are sending images of each other, sexting, this sort of stuff. Mm. We're describing that as normative because a lot of them are doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean it's normal, healthy or developmentally appropriate. We need to draw that distinction. Just because everyone's doing it doesn't mean it's right. The worrying aspect of this is that she's doing this performatively. So there's something about this being captured online, friends cheering, and it being some sort of a kind of a viral thing that's being sent around. My worry here is that this child is getting into doing something, sort of a performative act in order to get notoriety or visibility or some sort of an identity for herself.
It seems to be nothing to do with the emotional connection of a kiss or fancying a boy.
I don't get any sort of intimate desire from this picture or what this lady is describing. I get this. And you'd be surprised how especially young girls get corralled into having to be wild or risky because they want to establish a sense of belonging within a group. But that has huge costs to their own relationship with their own bodies and as they develop through later adolescence and even into early adulthood. And we need this child and this young girl needs to be sat down and have a chat about, and you need to have an uncomfortable conversation here about intimacy, about relationships. Mm. Because if she's engaging in these acts for the purposes of notoriety, visibility, identity, the motivation behind it is that it's skewing her desire in that sense, and it will skew the template of what she understands intimate relationships to be, which is a hard pattern to undo later on. I would have the difficult conversation. Mum has said, is there anything I did to cause this? I'm never keen as saying parents are always part of the problem, but I would always say a parent is always part of the solution. So
yes.
Because you are where you are, so sit down, speak with your daughter, have the awkward conversation, give her a lens of reality of what intimacy is. It's very difficult when she's 12 to get the nuances behind that, but try and develop her sense of that and try to find her sense of belonging a different way, because this could be just a naive, lost kid who's trying to find her way in a group and is finding herself...
And equally, it's important for, 12, 13, 14, 15, they're going to be kissing, they're going to be having their first feelings, they're going to be, that's all part of it. And so I know it seems very performative here, and that's the issue for so many parents that, I mean, the phone thing is a problem.
That's
when you think
worry.
Back, like,
that's
to spin the bottle, I was just, when you were talking away there, remember the spin the bottle game? Did you ever?
Yes, absolutely.
And there was, when you were around your friends, there was that sort of uncomfortable times when...
And we need that discomfort, and we need to be able to mix gendered situations, but Catherine, the Tinderization of society and the pornification of society has completely altered that. Those days that you talk about there are long gone. Mm. There are the virtual influence on intimacy development is massive in terms of how young people are having
an understanding of themselves,
what their roles are,
what is a relationship,
what's the meaningfulness of it, and our technologies allows us to skip steps and go to the outcome and disregard the process. And if you do that in emotional and intimacy development, you're going to have issues with regards to your skipped important steps that you actually needed to go through. Mm. And
So as a parent then, being part of this solution, what are the steps? What do you need to do?
You have to do exactly what we have to do in all walks of life around the technology evolution, which is, these children have come into the middle of a conversation and we need to tell them what has gone before. So where they miss these steps, we need to rewalk them through and say, the quickest point to A to C, you're missing B and C, and we need to actually sit down and tell you what those are, because technology is about gratification. So this is a very gratification focused, and they will send, it sells intimacy as gratification, but intimacy is about fulfillment. If you say to you, do you love your partner? You might say yes, and I won't be able to tell you, well, when did that happen? Mm. They'll say it happened over a period of time. It's a fulfilling thing, whereas sexual gratification is much more immediate, and technology is a gratification type culture. It's not a fulfillment culture. So we're rubbishing things that require fulfillment and focusing on things that involve gratification, and children are missing steps, really, really important steps in this, and as parents we need to walk them through it.
Okay.
In a time where the conversations with our children are so premium and so limited because of the distraction of technology, they've actually never been more important than they are right now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Coleman, I have a four-year-old boy who is very hyper and shouty and I'm constantly telling him to calm down. I find myself losing it and I don't know, and I know I don't help matters, but it's constant making noises and blah, blah, like sounds. Today we went shopping and he was in on top of his little sister in her buggy, frustrating her. She's only 16 months. I feel he's attention seeking. He's also started to leave going to the toilet for a number two too late and messes his underwear. He is toilet trained. It's a recent thing, the messing of the underwear. I'm wondering, are the two related?
Possibly. I mean, first of all, I'd say to any parent who's struggling with this, you're human. You're managing a tyrannical four-year-old is would try anyone's patience. And all the books about being calm and staying, it's really unrealistic to say that you would keep that. So don't give yourself, I mean, obviously you have to keep that in check and you have to try your best to be manageable, but acknowledge the humanness of everybody.
The
in
frustration.
Terms of that. But in this issue, it's important to say some children will struggle with attention and concentration for reasons that are not within their own control. And I'm talking about kind of the pathological idea of ADHD. I'm not saying your child has this, but there are children who struggle with this. And when you're disciplining a child or trying to sanction, you have to decide, is my child unwilling to behave or are they unable to behave? And the distinction between unwilling and unable are completely different because the approach demands a completely different approach. So someone who's unable needs support to be able to behave and someone who's willing needs sanction to do it. So you need to kind of try and establish that. The issue with the toilet training and the accidents, that to me is about disorganization and inattention. So they're not attending to their needs. They're not kind of organized enough to be able to do that.
So it's not attention seeking.
I wouldn't have thought it's attention seeking. Mm. But attention seeking, let's try and rephrase that. Attention seeking is relationship seeking. That's what a child is doing. When they're misbehaving, they're trying to get visibility. And they're far more likely to get visibility when they're misbehaving than behaving. So we have to change that and flip that on its head. So I'm saying to parents, catch your child being good. Catch them, reward them when they're quiet. When two siblings are fighting all the time, they're in the room quiet, we tend to go, leave them be. Yeah. Don't go near them. Don't go in there.
Oh my God.
Actually, that's the time to go in, and your previous guest would probably give out to me for this, and give the treat and say, guys, well done. You're sitting here watching telly and you're not fighting, and it's lovely to see. So you're rewarding the visibility and catching them being good.
That's so interesting.
So that the relationship seeking is much more likely when you're behaving yourself than misbehaving. Because when you're wagging fingers and shouting at them and roaring them in the car seats, that's relationship. It's a bad relationship, but it's a relationship nonetheless. If they feel they're not getting that, and the only way that they can secure your attention is through doing that, and we fall into the trap of only giving attention when they're misbehaving, we cause that behavior to continue and continue. So break the cycle, catch them being good, and just see, because attending to the misbehavior and the visibility issue, all of children who are seeking relationships seek attention.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. Listen, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much, Coleman Nochter. That is all we have time for today. Mary Wilson is next on Drive Time. Have a great afternoon, and I will be back tomorrow.